Since you're not Robert, I guess you're going to argue today, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Deborah, would you call the case, please?
May I please the court? Mr. Allen Steele will argue for the appellant. Mr. Lori Casper will argue for the state.
All right.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And may it please the court. Again, I'm Alan Steele, and I have the honor of being here with Mr. Matt Mills today on behalf of Carrie Bell, the appellant in this case. I guess what we're talking about here, this case boils down mainly to competency. That's the issue before the court, is whether or not the appellant, whether or not Carrie Bell was competent to stand trial, and whether or not the court committed a harmful, painful error in failing to conduct at minimal some type of informal inquiry into whether he was competent.
Why didn't you raise in the motion for new trial? You know, you can raise competence at any time. They could have acquitted.
Your Honor, I came into this case later. I'll gladly admit that. But at this point, we're not necessarily required to. The judge had made his position clear, and just based on track record.
Well, if you want a judge to find somebody incompetent, you don't think it's important to get something on the record asking him to find him incompetent?
I do, Your Honor, and I can't say why that wasn't done by trial counsel even, and that's an issue that's raised in the state's brief.
Where did you go to law school?
I went to law school here, Judge, at Westland. So.
Okay. Well, Walter Steele used to say, you don't raise competence until you find out whether the jury is going to acquit, because you'd rather have them acquit than have your client found incompetent and put in a mental hospital. So that's a question of trial strategy when you raise the question of competence, because you can raise it in a motion for new trial. You can raise it after it's up on appeal. You can raise it any time.
Fair enough, and that's why we're here. Although I think that the state of the law now has changed.
Well, that's true.
I think we're at a point now where, and the legislature has clearly noticed this, and I think their amendments to statutes and their new laws over the past several legislative sessions make it clear that we are so concerned with the fact that we've been sending mentally retarded, mentally incompetent, mentally impaired people to prison, and we're filling our prisons with them, that we need to address the issue. And so I think the state of the law has changed to the point now to where I just don't believe that that's an acceptable strategy anymore. I understand the former argument of, you wait and see. But as the Pate Court told us, the U.S. Supreme Court told us in Pate, you can't waive an incompetency issue. It can never be waived, which is why it's acceptable to bring it up here now. But how do you expect someone to assist you in their own trial? How do you expect someone to assist you in defending themselves in this fundamental right if they weren't competent in the first place? And I believe that's the state of the law we're at now.
Okay, what is there in the record that shows he was unable to assist in his defense? That's where I'm stuck.
Right, I understand, because he didn't testify in this case. And the only time it was really brought up was when Mr. DeWitt argued that his confession or his statements to the investigator were involuntary. Now, that's minimal, but that is at least some indication. And, Judge, we're not asking for him to be found incompetent at this point. What we're saying is the judge had a duty, and because he failed in his duty to at least conduct this minimal inquiry, this informal inquiry required by 46B, we don't know whether he was competent at that point or not. And because we can't say, we need to go back, find out if he's competent now, and if he is, then have a trial where we know for a fact that he can assist, that we know for a fact that he's competent for a trial, and we don't assume. And that issue, this indication.
Isn't there a presumption that he's competent?
The law sets forth a presumption, but the law also sets forth this standard of course, the law has been changed. The law was changed in 2004, and 46B was put in place to give us this suggestion of incompetency, any suggestion. And the Court of Criminal Appeals in Montoya this year, or I guess we've changed years now, in 09, told us, you know, we're going to go back to the old standard under MATA, this bona fide doubt standard. But MATA was never meant to be all-inclusive. And MATA itself said this is a deceptively simple concept. It's a fluid concept. There's no clear litmus test. And there was more than enough evidence in this case to raise a suggestion to the trial court. I think any reasonable judge looks at this case and goes, well, first of all, the case involves two individuals who are confined to a home for the mentally retarded or the mentally disabled. They couldn't care for themselves. And to suggest that, well, that doesn't even, I mean, set off some type of bell in the judge's mind that, you know, maybe this is a case where we have an incompetency issue. I mean, that just doesn't make sense. We have that. We have evidence in the record that he was, that Mr. Bell was mentally retarded. The test is before 18, and he had been. And we talk about all these other mental illnesses that are going on, the bipolar disorder and things like that.
What is an overall age equivalent of 8 years and 2 months?
Judge, that's the adaptive social and educational level, and that's set forth by the psychologist. And I'll admit readily that that wasn't developed further. I mean, really, all we have is just a few pages in the record. But that few pages is enough to raise that suggestion with the trial court. Now, the cases are clear, and Montoya restated that it doesn't have to be enough to establish absolute incompetency. It has to raise a bona fide doubt, a question, and then we move on to a formal hearing, if it's needed, to decide whether or not he's incompetent.
Anybody request a D&E?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Anybody request a D&E?
I'm not familiar with that abbreviation, Judge.
The diagnosis and evaluation where they do the adaptive level and the do, you know, they bring in the social worker and the nurse and everybody to do all the testing to determine.
It was not done for this case.
Was it requested?
It was not requested to my knowledge, Judge. And after I've spoken with trial counsel, and he never requested it. I know that's not in the record, but he tells me he never requested it. The only thing he relied on were the MHMR records. And those are the same MHMR records that, again, from the record, establish that he's mentally retarded, that he's got bipolar disorder, that he's got a history of health problems, that he takes all these medications. And quite frankly, that's also established in the video. This state's exhibit, the statement establishes, you know, that he's in a home for the mentally retarded.
Where did you get the overall adaptive level of 8 years and 2 months?
That comes from the defense's only exhibit, which is the MHMR records from Pecan Valley MHMR, entered into evidence in the defense's case in chief.
Exactly what is it you're asking for?
Judge, what we're asking for, or I'm sorry, Justice McCoy, what we're asking for is this case to be sent back for someone to actually do an evaluation on this kid to find out if he was ever competent.
Well, if they find out he was competent, why would he be entitled to a new trial?
Because, and again, this is set forth in Pate. This is the U.S. Supreme Court, and it's a concept that, you know, competency is at the moment of trial. So he may be competent now. Nobody can say for sure whether or not he was competent on the day of trial. The scientific evidence, I mean, it's just not possible. So to go back and conduct a competency evaluation and say, well, he's competent now, which, you know, may or may not be the case, that defies the medical concepts. We can't tell if he was competent then. We can just tell that the judge erred in not conducting any type of inquiry into whether or not he was competent. And that same argument leads us into the other issue.
But there are cases where there was a determination at the appellate level that cases are remanded, abated and remanded during appeal for a determination of whether the defendant was competent at the time of trial.
But, Justice Stefano, I mean, to do that now, some months in the future, honestly, it just defies the medical concepts. And that's what the Pate Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, relied on. Because we're trying to determine at a moment in time. Now, granted, the fact that this defendant is mentally retarded has not changed and will not change from everything we know about medical concepts. And from what the literature tells us, that comes along with mental illness, other mental illnesses, like the bipolar disorder in this case. And that's not going to change. That's still going to be the same. But there is some indication, and again, this is according to some of the secondary sources, some of the law review articles that are cited in the brief, that suggests that there is almost this learning concept that people who take, for example, IQ tests too often, even when they're mentally retarded, they start to learn those tests and their IQ is falsely increased. And that's why the suggestion is out there that we can't just use one bright line rule, that we can't just say this is a number we're sticking with on IQ and this is where we go.
All right. In light of Pate, you're saying you don't want us to abate for determination of competence at time of trial.
In light of Pate, Your Honor, I'm asking that the court send it back. It's worth the time and effort to get it right, to make sure that it was right. And so I'm asking the court to remand for first a competency evaluation and then a new trial if the defendant is found competent or if the appellant is found competent.
Why would a clever lawyer not use this to get two bites at the apple? You go to trial, you don't bring up competency. If he's found not guilty, he's off. Then later, we'll appeal that he was incompetent so that we can send it back. And if, in fact, he was incompetent and it should have been brought up the first time, well, and even if he's found competent, I get another bite at the apple. I'm almost getting three bites at the apple.
But you're presuming incompetence. You're presuming that he wasn't competent at the first trial.
Well, let me address Justice McCoy's point first. I can't speak for other lawyers.
Well, I'm not talking about you. I'm just talking about the idea,
the concept.
We could get two or three bites at the apple by just not bringing it up.
Well, I would hope that our ethical concept would prevent such a thing, but I won't deny that's a possibility. But that's what the standard, this some evidence suggesting and this informal inquiry are designed to prevent. It takes just a few minutes, and I can say this with certainty because I did one last week downstairs. It takes just a few minutes out of the court's time to do it. So, I mean, what you're asking me is what's to prevent the bar from doing this? And I think the idea behind the law and the precedent is that the bench will cure that problem. The bench will do this, and that will prevent the problem. And so by sending this case back, you're not giving the bar a new suggestion. You're not suggesting to defense attorneys that they do this. What's happening is the trial court is then the one that has to pick up the slack and do what the law requires. And I'm sorry, Justice D'Ofano, you had a secondary question, which was, are we presuming incompetence? And I know my time's almost up, and I'll cover this briefly. I'm not presuming incompetence. What I'm suggesting to you is that there is more than enough evidence here that suggested that it was a major possibility. Having a new trial based on that concept is not a presumption. It's just an opportunity to make sure that we get it right. This is such a main focus of our society now, and it is such a key problem, and our prisons are becoming so overfilled with people.
Yeah, but you're saying if he's found competent, then he gets a new trial. And that didn't make any sense to me. If it's found that he was probably incompetent at the time of trial, that does make sense. But if it's remanded and he's found to be competent, then we do it all over again when there's really no evidence, only a suggestion that he wasn't competent. I'm just having trouble grasping that.
Are we through, Judge?
Yeah.
Mr. Steele, the state of the record would reflect from the playing of the confession, recorded confession, that there was more admitted in the confession that occurred between the two mentally retarded people. According to what was said by the appellant in the recorded statement, as opposed to what was testified from the stand by Mr. Webb. And is that in and of itself some evidence of the lack of competence on the part of the appellant whenever he's confessing to things that are greater than is identified by the person who made the outcry?
Justice Meyer, that, and if I may briefly,
yes.
That goes into the confession issue. And Justice Stefano, I'm not trying to ignore your question.
No, that's fine.
That gets more into the third and fourth points of error that we're arguing on the confession issue. And, of course, the brief points out that these mentally retarded individuals are susceptible to this type of influence. And they suffer.
I want to please you by answering questions so that you're happy with my answers as opposed to what's the truth.
Yes, Your Honor. And quite frankly, that is something that if you watch the exhibit throughout, you can see that, because it's not just confessing to more than this complaining party complained of, but he keeps adding and he keeps requesting getting it right. And I understand the concept of, you know, not trying to benefit him by not having counsel complain at trial of his incompetence. And if he's competent when he goes back, or he's likely competent now, to answer your question, Justice Hoffman, the issue that I think we come to a head with is, yes, I believe that the video can establish additional incompetence, but if he's found competent now, was he competent then? And we'll just never know. And our system can't afford to be based on a we think and we may never know. And this is not an every case thing. This is a case where the judge made an error. We're not asking you to let him go. We're not asking you to undo it totally. We're just asking for a new trial so that we can make sure that we get it right, especially in this case. If there's no further questions, I'll sit.
Thank you. Why didn't the state suggest a competency determination?
At trial, Your Honor?
Yes.
There was no evidence at trial.
An 8-year, a 2-month adaptive age?
Well, I believe that's a little bit misleading. If you look at the entire MHMR record, you see that this defendant had an IQ of 76, which is mildly retarded.
This says 66.
If you look at...
sorry, the brief says 66. So is the brief incorrect?
Well, if you look at the entire... And I may have...
It says, these records suggest that Carrie Bell has a full-scale IQ of 66, an overall age equivalent of 8 years and 2 months, and is mentally retarded.
Okay. If you...
I'm not saying that's
give
right.
Give me
I'm
a second.
What the brief
give
says.
Me a second to look. The MHMR...
Clerk's record 33.
Determination, yes, Your Honor. I have that in front of me.
But regardless, if those three factors appear in the record, I mean, that's just not a red flag. That's a, you know, that's a bottle rocket going off.
Well, let me address, if you will, what the court said in Montoya as far as raising a bona fide doubt as to a defendant's competency. And they just reiterated in 2009 what that standard is. Bona fide doubt is truly bizarre behavior, which we have no evidence of that.
That's
in the
for
record.
Insanity. That's not for
it's
retardation.
But it's for competence to stand trial. It's for the judge to conduct a competency hearing, which I believe is what the appellant is arguing, that the judge should have conducted a sua sponte hearing as to the competence of the defendant. And bona fide doubt has three factors. Truly bizarre behavior, which we have no evidence of that whatsoever. In the MHMR records or from the videotape or from any outbursts in court or anything like that. In fact, this defendant was incarcerated from the time of the offense, from the date of arrest until trial. There's no trips to Wichita Falls. There's no suicide reports. There's nothing in the record.
It's retardation.
You mean bizarre?
I understand that, Your Honor.
Bizarre behavior like saying that it would be the truth that the judge's robe was polka-dotted?
Well, now, that was the victim who was moderately retarded. That is not the appellant.
Sorry.
Okay. And the level of retardation is another factor. And the courts have said, this court has said in Franks, the Court of Criminal Appeals has said in Woods that the courts will go by the APA definition of retardation. This appellant is mildly retarded. The victim is at least moderately or severely retarded. So we need to keep those two things separate.
Then the complainant, I mean, doesn't that cast doubt on the reliability of his testimony? The fact that he's moderately to severely retarded?
That is one of the issues that the court may consider. And that's on another issue that the appellant pled, that the victim was not competent to testify. However, the law assumes that a victim is competent to testify. He was able to relate at least one of the instances of assault. He was able to point out the defendant and say, Carrie did this to me. He did, as Justice McCoy said, Meyer.
Justice McCoy, but it's right. And he said that the judge's black robe was polka-dotted.
At one point, yes, Your Honor. And there was no objection to his testimony at trial, to the victim's testimony. And, you know, we would say that wasn't even preserved as an issue for appeal. This is a very sad case. It's a mildly retarded man who has taken advantage of, and by his own words, targeted a moderately retarded child because he knew that the child was retarded and he knew he could take advantage of him, and he did. As far as...
And what was his IQ? You were going to look and check that.
Oh.
Was it 66 or 76? Because retardation doesn't begin until 70, below 70,
right? He had a verbal IQ of 67, a performance of 72, and a full scale of 66.
All right, so he's retarded.
Right, and that puts him in well within the mildly retarded category. And if I could go back to the bona fide doubt standard, the Montoya court just said that moderate retardation would be a red flag for bona fide doubt. This defendant, this appellant, was not even, he was barely, if you can say that, barely retarded.
Have you ever dealt with somebody with an IQ of 66? If you
yes,
ever sat down and had a conversation with them and asked them the questions that you ask to determine?
Yes, Your Honor, I have. In fact, I was a public school teacher for 26 years before I went to law school, so I have a lot of experience
with
dealing with
IQ of 66.
With dealing with people with variety of IQs.
Seems to me it's a factor of where this person was.
Pardon me?
His surroundings. He was in this home. He wasn't placed there because he was functioning well in society and didn't have any problems. I mean, to me, that's a flag. Whether or not that's one of those three on the list or not, I mean, kind of looks like we have to look at the whole person here.
Sure.
See if, you know, there's some indicators that we at least ought to just see if he's competent.
Well, and if you will look, Justice McCoy, at the exhibit that was entered, there's more than just an IQ score. An IQ score is only one piece of the puzzle. But if you look and see the MHMR report indicates that in area of social and communication skills, he's adequate expressive and receptive language skills. He can communicate his needs. He can respond appropriately in conversation.
That for an 8-year-old? Well, I mean, tell us about the 8-year-old, 8 years and 2 months.
You know, there's a reason we don't put people on trial when they're 8 years old, and it's not because they can't reach the water fountains.
I understand. But if we go back to, Justice Dofano, with all respect, we go back to the issue of competency. There was no indication in the record that he did not have sufficient present ability to consult with his lawyer. There's no indication that he didn't have an understanding of the proceedings against him, and those are the threshold issues in competence. Those are the threshold issues. The Montoya court said, and I believe this strongly, that the people that were in the courtroom, the people that were involved with this defendant, not appellant lawyers who never had any contact with him, but the people who were involved with him, those were the people who had the best idea of whether or not this defendant was presently competent to stand trial. And that issue was never raised at the court because it was never an issue that he was not competent to consult with his lawyer or to have an understanding of the proceedings against him. If you look at the videotape, and I know there was some question that was brought up about that, if you look at the videotape, it wasn't just a case of an investigator, a trained investigator, leading him down this garden path and saying, "You did this, didn't you? You did this, didn't you?" That never happened. If you look at the videotape, the investigator, who was aware that this gentleman was mildly retarded, actually went out of his way not to suggest answers, the same types of things that a person might do if you had a fully functioning adult. He said, "I need you to tell me the truth about what went on between you and Alex." Very next statement, "I touched him." "Where did you touch him at?" "In the private." "In his private, what did you touch him with?" "My hand." At one point, he asks...
Mr. Casper, right ahead yes, of sir. That, what you just read, the last sentence in the paragraph, right ahead of that, it says, "We just, okay, whatever it, that is good as it is bad, it is, okay? So we can understand fully what happened, all right, and I don't want anyone else at that home knowing that you came in here and you just lied about it." After the defendant has already stated he's worried about being there before the investigator Young because of the reason that he doesn't have any place else to live.
I understand that, and that brings up an interesting point, Justice Meyer. If he was concerned about losing his place to live, then he wouldn't come forward and admit, unprovoked by the investigator, that he touched him.
If he was competent, he wouldn't.
Yeah.
If he was incompetent, he first certainly might.
Well, with all due respect, Justice McCoy, we have fully functioning adults who do the exact same thing.
I mean, you or I wouldn't.
That happens.
That, but we're competent, I hope.
If you look at the if you look at the entirety of the videotaped statement, you'll see too that the appellant corrects the investigator at one point. He brings up he very specifically, methodically details three assaults that were the exact three assaults that he was charged with and he was convicted of. You know, we talk about Alex Webb getting up on the stand, the victim, and only admitting to the touching. But you also, if you look at the record, this was a 17-year-old man, young man at this time, who was moderately retarded, but he was smart enough to know that it's really embarrassing to talk about anal penetration by another man in front of a whole bunch of strangers. And he told the investigator that. He told his caregiver, whom he trusted, but people that he didn't know and people that he didn't trust, he would not bring that up. He would not talk about that because that was just, even as retarded as the victim was, that was too embarrassing for him to say in front of 12 strangers.
So by your standard, that makes the complainant competent to stand trial because he was embarrassed. I mean, I don't understand that reasoning, just being embarrassed.
No, I'm not saying that being embarrassed makes him competent. I'm just saying that
children hide behind chairs to dirty their diapers because they're embarrassed to do it in public, because I know.
I'm just saying that explains why on the stand that the victim talked about the touching but did not want to talk about the penetration. And that was clearly an issue that was that was too embarrassing for him, and he just shut down. And that's, you know, when you deal with people that have this kind of, this type of retardation that the victim had, it becomes obvious that that's what went on in the courtroom.
Okay, the complainant was how old when this?
16 at the time of the assault.
16.
And the appellant was 21 at the time of the assault. And he knew that as well. And he says that in the videotape. He said, I was 21 and he was 16. And I knew I could take advantage of him. And so I did. Justice McCoy brings up an important point about getting a second bite of the apple. I see that my time is almost up. I think that's exactly what's happening in this case. It's interesting that appellant admits that nobody brought this up at trial, that the trial counsel didn't bring it up, but yet he doesn't claim ineffective assistance of counsel. That's not even one of his 8 points of error, ineffective assistance. That seems like if you're going to complain that this wasn't brought up at trial, that would be the exact thing that you'd want to bring up, is that the counsel should have brought that up. We just disagree with the appellant that there was more than enough evidence to support incompetency at trial. Appellant did not overcome the threshold of rebutting or overcoming the presumption of competence. There couldn't have been a bona fide doubt in the judge's mind. We were all of those of us who were in the courtroom could see that this defendant had the present ability to consult with his lawyer. He had the present ability to understand what was going on, and that's the threshold for competence. And that's what we have here. We would ask you respectfully to consider all of the evidence and to uphold the decisions of the trial court, uphold this conviction for Alex Webb.
Casper.
Yes.
There's some evidence. There was some statement in the briefs that there was a plea bargain arranged or between defense counsel and prosecutor for a 5-year sentence, and that was rejected by the court. What's that about?
Your Honor, I am not. That is not coming back to my mind. I don't know. I don't know what that was about.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm sorry. Thank you.
Justice Meyer, if I may briefly, again, I wasn't part of the trial counsel in this case, so I can't tell you the circumstances of the plea that you're referring to. I know it is in the clerk's record that it was agreed to, and I've spoken with trial counsel, and he said it was agreed, but the judge rejected it. The notation is the record. The judge would allow the jury to decide, but there's nothing on in the reporter's record as far as any testimony being taken to that issue or anything. Just in the interest of disclosure, I wanted to make sure I pointed that out. As the court's pointed out, we have this issue of 8 years, 2 months, and 66 is the overall. There's three different IQ scores given for Carrie Bell. There's these three IQ scores, and I'm not a psychologist, so I can't tell you what it means other than to say the overall IQ score was 66, which should have raised some flag, along with the fact that, as Justice McCoy, I believe you pointed out, Carrie Bell was in a home. He was paid for by Medicaid. That's in the record. He was kept there because he just didn't have the ability to care for himself. And that in itself should have raised the issue. The state raises the issue of the people who are in the courtroom are the ones that are best equipped to raise the issue. And that goes only to that third prong of MATA. Or, I guess, I say MATA, that's where the test came from. Montoya readopted that third prong of, behavior at trial. Because I hope that the state wasn't privileged to confidential communications, if there were any, between Mr. Bell and his counsel. And his counsel did, in fact, raise the issue of the confession not being voluntary. And while he doesn't fully develop that, I think it's kind of plain on the face that the reason he's arguing that is this appellant, Kerry Bell, is mentally retarded. He lives in a home for the mentally retarded, and therefore he just wasn't competent to give this confession. That makes it involuntary. Because he raises that issue, we can then move that over to the issue we're talking about right now, which is whether or not he was competent to stand trial and whether or not trial counsel had any indication or indicated to the court in any way that Kerry Bell wasn't competent to stand trial. And that, I'll submit to you, is some indication. It's not a lot of indication. Again, in the brief, there's some discussion of other reasons other than the Walter Steele's beliefs on why you might not want to raise whether or not someone is incompetent to stand trial. A lot of lawyers apparently are,
Well, you raise it when they say, is there any reason sentence should not be pronounced at this time? Yeah, he's incompetent to stand trial, and that gets you a hearing right then and there at the time he's in trial to determine his level of competence.
And I'll admit that, you know, that wasn't done here. And Ms. Casper raises the issue of, you know, am I arguing ineffective assistance and why aren't we? And I'm well aware of the jurisprudence on raising ineffective assistance counsel on direct appeal. And I know the court's preference not to have that done on direct appeal. We don't have any affidavits or anything from trial counsel to go by. So it's just not proper. It's just not able to be developed here at this point. And that's better saved for later. And so that's why it's not raised here. I can't say for certain whether trial counsel was ineffective. And I know trial counsel. I prefer to give him the benefit of the doubt, honestly. But it's not raised here for that reason. And even though it's not, to go back and continually argue, well, he was ineffective, you didn't raise it, is kind of suggesting that this constitutional error should overrule this constitutional error and blame one against the other, and that just doesn't make any sense. You spent some time with Ms. Casper discussing Mr. Webb, the complaining witness, and one thing I want to get out is that we should not be trying to compare the competence of Mr. Webb with the competence of Kerry Bell, because that's just not something that applies under 46B. We're not supposed to be trying to compare Alexander Webb and Kerry Bell to see which one was more competent for purposes of trial or anything. And that's the suggestion I'm getting from the state's brief and from the state. It's not the same. Now, they're two separate issues. And as to whether or not there was an objection to Alexander Webb testifying, the judge conducted a voir dire of Mr. Webb on his own volition. There's no need for a defense attorney to request a hearing when the judge is already doing the hearing in open court in front of everybody, and the witness is saying he's wearing a polka dot robe and he's unable to effectively narrate and recall what he's just said. It's just counterintuitive. And so I see my time is up. If there's no more questions from the bench, I want to thank you for your time. I want to thank you for granting oral argument in this case. And I hope you'll see fit to give Kerry Bell another chance to get back and let's find out if he's competent and make sure the system's working the way it's supposed to be. Thank you.
Thank you. I do appreciate your argument. Appreciate you coming all this way to give us this assistance. Your case is submitted, and you're free to go about your business. And that being our last case for oral submission, the court will be adjourned.